Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Herd Tell.
Hi, welcome back to Herd Tell. Okay, we like to sometimes just dig into multiple issues because, you know, one of our things is we don't like the buzzwords because buzzwords make you dumb, kind of like sports and money and alcohol. But we like to get into things a little more in depth, so we brought up back our friend Benjamin Ihaney, and he's got a new book out. Nice book. I like it, Beyond Intention. We're going to talk through some economic things, some societal things, but he does what we just said. He actually digs into it a little bit. He's a graduate of the University of Minnesota. He's going to go back to law school. I don't know why you want to do that. You must be a glutton for punishment, my friend. But you've seen him Wall Street Journal, Fox News, Newsweek, all over the place. And he's been on here. I went and looked. I forgot. You've been on here 6 times. It didn't seem like that, but it's been a while. How are you, sir?
Well, it's great to be back, Andrew. Thanks for having me on. How are you doing?
I'm thrilled to have you, although you made me read another book, which, you know, I hate. Nah, I'm kidding. I love reading. I want to address it this way because I like what you did, and we're going to link to the book so you can get to it, but you just kind of took a couple of the big ticket items and just walked through them. Here's my thing, and we were talking about this a minute ago. Almost any plan on paper sounds good. You can pitch it, and a lot of them would actually work in a perfect world, but a lot of this stuff, we're not in a perfect world, and somewhere between the theory of it and the actual execution of it, you got to put in the human factors. You got to put in things like economics and other things like this. That's kind of the nitty gritty on this stuff, isn't it? It's like taking, okay, the theory sounds good. The buzzword sounds good. The argument on talking heads like we're doing right now sounds good. But when you go to apply this stuff, it's not even really does it work or not, because you can make anything work if you get enough power and horsepower behind it, right? It's what are the unintended repercussions if you make it work or if you do it halfway and it doesn't work. In a lot of ways, that's even the bigger mess, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of really idealistic proposals for, you know, various policy in our country right now. And we need to really work through the weeds on, you're right that almost anything can work if you get enough political power behind it. It at least can work for a certain amount of time. Until it collapses. At the end of the day, you know, there are constraints on what we can achieve. There's not a limitless supply on, you know, money, on hours in a day, on individuals that can, you know, contribute labor to various goals. So you can make anything work for a short period of time, but at a certain point, you're going to run up, you know, on resource constraints, you're going to run up on incentive issues, you're going to, you know, run into all kinds of, you know, human you know, practical and even sometimes moral problems that, you know, make certain policy proposals, you know, impractical at the end of the day. And it's important when we're thinking about what sort of policies we want to implement in this country or in our states, our localities, whatever it may be, we can't merely consider what we want to accomplish, you know, who we want to help, how we want to help them. We have to understand, like you said, the various unintended consequences that might pop up, you know, from the do-goodism that, you know, we feel inside of ourselves. We have to understand, you know, basic economic principles, I think, are incredibly important. We can have all of, you know, all of the grand ideas out there to help people, but if we don't understand the basic principles of economics, then we're very unlikely to succeed in our goals of helping, you know, the individuals that we aim to.
I've been doing this a while, and one thing I find, because I like talking policy, I'm one of those people, I like talking policy, I like talking theology, I like, you know, big ticket, pie in the sky things. But one of the things about talking about something like policy, like theology, like anything that's kind of a hot button issue is, if you're in an academic setting or a small group setting or a couple of friends setting or a peer group setting, those conversations are very, very fruitful, right? Because it's people on an equal footing. They have kind of an equal background and knowledge. They have an equal goal of, we disagree on this, but we all, you know, we all want to help the poor come up economically. We all want to solve child hunger. We want to fix the healthcare system. We want to talk about labor, you know, fair labor and fair wages, whatever the case may be. Those are things people all want. They disagree on how to get there. The problem I find right now in our current discourse is we're not doing those in those settings anymore. We're doing them on social media and we're doing them on talking heads and we're doing them on monetized internet talks. And look, we're all guilty of it. You and me both write opinion pieces. Those outlets are not real great for deep policy discussion because, like you just said, you have a policy discussion, but you devoid it of morality or economics or political theory. It's going to fall apart really quickly. But you can't fit that into, you know, the characters on Twitter. You can't fit that onto an Instagram post. You can't fit that into a 750-word op-ed when they're like, 750 words, that's all you got, get it in, right? Part of this is just the environment we're in, right, where we're trying to take those real high-minded ivory tower academic conversations and we're trying to have them on social media and it falls apart, which means people just fall to their buzzwords and emotions on a lot of it.
Yeah, and on social media, you hit the nail on the head there, especially on social media, you know, individuals have to take their ideas, and let's say we're talking about Twitter, for example, they have to put them in a small tweet to try to make some grand point, or if they pay for premium, then they can write out a longer tweet. But at the end of the day, when you're going to a site to, you know, get quick, you know, ideas, to get quick information, quick stimuli, a lot of people are going to skip over those longer tweets or those huge threads that really dig into an issue, because if they wanted to go, you know, find that sort of information, they'd probably pick up a book. They might go to a long forum, you know, publication like The Atlantic, for example. You know, there's a lot in The Atlantic that I disagree with. One thing I do appreciate is that they have very long forum articles where their writers really dig into issues. It not only allows you to understand their point of view better, but it also allows you to respond to it better. It challenges your beliefs more. It forces you really to reckon with the best version of, you know, arguments that you agree with or don't agree with. And we definitely don't get that on social media anymore. And unfortunately, it feels like the social media conversations are, you know, being exported into the real world, right? We spend a lot of time online. Individuals become accustomed to using a lot of buzzwords. They become accustomed to having their discussions devolve into massive arguments without actually respecting the points of view of the other people, because they're used to just being on the other side of a keyboard or of a phone screen. And I actually see individuals start to take the sort of behavior that is incentivized online and take it into the real world. And so when they do even have those opportunities to have kind of productive conversations, when they're maybe sitting around with friends or, you know, family or whatever, wherever they may be in the real world, sometimes they fall back into those bad habits that we're seeing online. Now, I don't want to disparage social media or the web too much here, because I actually think that these are wonderful creations. I'm a huge fan of X in a lot of ways. I use Instagram every once in a while, although I try and delete it during the week so that I don't spend too much time on it. You know, the online world allows us to get quick information, allows us to stay up to date, but it definitely fosters some bad habits and discussion. And I think we definitely need to reclaim, you know, civility. We need to reclaim our ability to dig into the weeds a little bit.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, Benjamin Ianian joining us. You touched on that. One of the first topics in your book is a perfect example of this. You did a chapter on minimum wage. I think minimum wage arguments is one of those things. We talked about this some during the pandemic, though, and I've been talking to my kids about it because three of my kids are now technically adults, 18, 21, and 26. You know, so they're all working now, right? They all try to get jobs. One of the things I've told my kids about their jobs is like, your first job is going to suck. That's the whole point. You got to get a bad job, prove you'll be pretty good in the bad. Sometimes you get lucky, but usually your first job ain't a great job. You're just getting it to get the next job, right? Because once you get a job, now you can get a job. You don't have a job, nobody will give you a job. It's just one of those universal things. I think social media has really changed the labor discussion, whether it's minimum wage. During COVID, we saw this. A lot of people's like, well, why are all these service workers going from place to place to place? You had all the signs out of fast food places and places like this, like how much they're going to offer and their benefits and all that. I think a lot of that got driven by things like social media and the internet and the discourse, because all of a sudden people realize what other people make. They realize they have options. They realize there was a scarcity. They realize that COVID shut things down. And when you get to something like the minimum wage, people are just more aware of how wages work, how labor works, how the labor market's doing. They get more news about things like the unemployment rate, about things like real adjusted inflation, things like this. I think this is one of those topics that's a good example of what you're just talking about. I think people just have more awareness and they're like, oh, well, I'm making $415 here. That place down there is making $1,650. I'm going to switch jobs. And then we have these think pieces like, why aren't they staying in their jobs? Like, well, because they got options now.
Yeah, absolutely. Options are a huge driver of, you know, people's wages. So a huge misconception, I would say, in the labor markets that I often see is a lot of people seem to believe that the federal minimum wage level dictates the wages that hourly, you know, wage workers are paid. And that's just simply not true. You know, supply and demand are two very basic economic principles that can be applied to understand all of the most hotly debated economic policy debates in our country right now. And if we have more supply for jobs than there are workers, then you're going to see upward pressure on the price of labor. You know, when we have demand for workers and there's not enough of them to fill all those jobs, they're going to get offered better salaries, you're going to get offered, you know, better wages, better benefits, better hours, maybe. It's really important, and I do think it did come out of COVID a little bit. It's really important for people to understand that the level that the federal government says is the lowest that you can pay someone is not actually what dictates the wages of you know, hourly wage workers. Actually, in 2021, I believe it was 98% of wage-based workers, 16 years and older, made over $7.25 an hour. And $7.25 an hour is the federal minimum wage. But a lot of people still believe that, well, if the federal minimum wage doesn't rise, then, well, people aren't going to get paid more. And that's just simply not true. It comes down to, you know, the incentives. It comes down to basic economics and trying to have the government raise the minimum that, you know, you can pay an individual. As you just pointed out, you want to get the first job so you can get the next job, right? Well, if we raise the minimum wage so high that it becomes, you know, unprofitable for businesses to pay workers with less skill, it becomes unprofitable for employers to pay workers with less experience, then those people are going to have a hard time finding a job. And then it's going to be even harder for them to make ends meet and to move up in the world and let's say, find that second job. And so if we raise the minimum wage really high, then we're really going to be cutting off the lower rungs of the ladder for the individuals who need it most.
Yeah, and I find it interesting. This is anecdotal, but my college-age kid, she's in the same hometown I grew up in, kind of helping take care of my parents, finishing up her college, that sort of thing. She's working across the parking lot from where I had my first, you know, not my first job, but my first W-2 official kind of, you know, 9-to-5 sort of job, although I work swing shift. You know, I started out $5.15 minimum wage at the time, right? Of course, this is, you know, 25 years ago or so. And then I got bumped up to $5.35 because I was working night shift and I thought I was rich because, you know, you're young and stupid and don't know any better. She's across that same parking lot all this time now. She started out $16 an hour because they just can't get enough service sector workers, you know, entry level service sector work. I'm not going to reveal where. $16 an hour across the parking lot from the same place I started out at $5.15 an hour. That blows my mind. Now, I understand the economics of why that is. We've had inflation, wage growth, all that sort of stuff. But there is this thing where I think one thing we leave out of the minimum wage argument is minimum wage disproportionately affects the service side of the economy. It just does. It's kind of what it's aimed at. And I still don't think America's psyche has switched to we are a services-based economy. Overwhelmingly, over something like 60% of the economy is service-based stuff. Now, we're not a manufacturing economy. We're a service sector economy. So the minimum wage debate is actually more important than ever, but it's also more detached from reality than it's ever really been. And now you've got things like AI and kiosks and stuff like that. So those wages are going up because you got to know how to use computers. You got to have certain job skills. You have different manpower requirements because some of the, you know, just putting a kiosk in doesn't mean you have less manpower. It means you have different manpower because now you got to have somebody who runs the kiosk, right? I think the conversation has changed on us, but we haven't changed the nomenclature and we haven't changed our perception of it yet. Is that a fair way to address the minimum wage issue?
I think that's a fair framing of how this discussion is going in America today. We have not understood in a lot of ways exactly who it's going to affect the most, how it's going to affect the most. Now, the people who debate these policies all day long understand it. But it's important for you know, the everyday man and woman. So, you know, the book that I wrote on, you know, debating progressive economic policy proposals, on advocating more for free market based solutions to the problems we want to solve, I wrote for the everyday man and woman, right? It's important for everyday voters, the people on social media who we're going to debate these policies with, you know, the people writing op-eds. It's important for everybody to really understand the context of all of these policy debates, who these policies are going to affect, how they're going to affect them. And we are, you know, a very service-based economy. And like you said, you know, $16 an hour, a lot more than the $5 an hour and change that you were making in the past. Those wages rise because they need workers. It's that simple. It's not because the government has mandated it. It's not because any coercion is applied to these businesses where they're forced, you know, behind the point of a gun to pay higher wages. It's because they need to pay them to attract workers. Supply and demand is what is going to change wages. And the problem is that if we raise the minimum wage and we handicap employers, the service economy, which is the basis for much of our economy, as you pointed out, is going to be hamstrung. Right? They're going to be constrained in what they can accomplish, what kind of plans they can invest in, how much they can grow, how many workers they can hire. And all of a sudden, workers are going to be left in a worse place, and consumers are probably going to be left in a worse place as well, because they're going to be left with higher prices as employers are going to have to try and offset some of this increased labor costs. So things become more unaffordable, spending might slow down, growth might slow down, job growth is going to slow down. So now you're not going to have to pay workers as much, except whatever that federally mandated rate is, but there's going to be fewer jobs for people. And so the problem is, it's a great intention to want to raise the federal minimum wage, but the unintended consequences would end up most negatively affecting the individuals that it's aimed to help.
Benjamin Ianian joining us. You had a stat about minimum wage that made me stop and think for a second, because, and again, I'm not against some form of federal intervention to make sure people have a minimum wage, not the buzzword, but just like, yes, you have to pay certain people a certain amount. The concept I'm fine with. This stat blew me away, though, that Bureau of Labor Statistics for 2021, these stats only come out every so many years. That's why a lot of times you got to use older stats, even though this is a pandemic year stat, obviously. But remember, that'll be for like 96 to 2000 kind of thing. 98% of the 76 million hourly paid workers over 16 years old made more than the $7.25 an hour minimum wage. If we're having this outsized conversation about 2% of the working population, which is what that stat's telling us, how do we get that more right-sized? Because one of the issues with a federal minimum wage is it is one size fits all, and California and West Virginia have very different labor markets. Let's just all be adults. Maine and Dallas, Texas have very different labor markets. So if we're going to have this one size fits all, not that there's not a, you know, probably in perfect theory saying, okay, you want to raise the floor up, fine. I can understand that argument. But this 2% of the working population, tinkering it with over and over and over again, it really feels like, and you touch on this a little bit as you write about the minimum wages, if you're tinkering with this 2% of the mostly entry-level workers, the ripple effects is having a disproportionate effect. Is that a fair way to lay it out?
Yeah, there's going to be a disproportionate effect on those entry-level workers, on the less skilled. So the least skilled workers, or least experienced workers, however you want to put it, are generally paid the lowest wages, right? Because that's what their productivity at the time is worth. But if you raise that federal minimum wage above a worker's productivity, then they're unlikely to hold on to a job. Because if it's not profitable for the employer, you know, if it's going to hurt their bottom line as opposed to help it, then they don't have an incentive to hire those entry-level workers. And it's going to have a ripple effect on those 2% of workers. And it's really going to disproportionately impact those states where things are less expensive and people are paid less at the same time. You make a great point. California and West Virginia are not the same places, right? So things are generally more expensive and wages are generally higher in more populated areas. And so if you raise the minimum wage a ton across the board, you're going to disproportionately impact poorer rural areas where things aren't as expensive and wages typically aren't as high. And you could cause really catastrophic ripple effects in those particular societies. And so it will have an outsized impact on those specific areas. Now, if we raise the federal minimum wage to over $15 an hour, which what as a lot of progressives are advocating for these days, you know, we're going to see an impact on a larger chunk of those 76, you know, million workers that from the statistic that you pointed out from my book. Right now we're talking about 2%, but if we more than double the $15, you know, if we more than double the minimum wage to $15 an hour, there's going to be a lot of workers who are affected by that. Some might lose their jobs. Some might have their hours cut. Certain businesses might not be able to run profitably in various localities. And so they'll shut down, which will then reduce job options in those areas, which will then reduce consumption options in those areas. We'll give, you know, businesses that do persist greater pricing power, which would then hurt the most financially constrained consumers. Like there's a huge ripple effect that can come from doubling, you know, the federal minimum wage. And some progressives are even advocating more for a $20 an hour minimum wage, you know, 17, 20, 25. You could go on the street and talk to progressives and say, would you guys support a $50 an hour minimum wage? And some of them will say yes. The only way to advocate, in my view, is what I try and lay out in the book. The only way to advocate for such a policy in good faith is to truly not understand the principles and the mechanisms of a market economy or of an economy in general. It's not feasible to raise the federal minimum wage to $50 an hour and believe, oh, everyone's just going to get paid $50 an hour. And I know a lot of people are going to lose their jobs and prices are going to rise. And so the lowest paid workers and the most financially constrained consumers, the people who policies such as these aim to help, are actually going to be the most harmed by it.
Yeah, Benjamin Ayanian. Joining us, he did his schooling up in Minnesota, a longtime Young Voices contributor, which is how I got to know him. Let's talk rent control for a minute, because here's another one. I want to, the buzzword of rent control, that'll bring different things to different people's mind. Most people's mind that just goes, oh, you're only allowed to pay X amount of rent. This is one we need to delve into what it actually means, though, because it has different meanings and different applications. If you have a policy of, you know, we all are familiar with zoning ordinances, like, okay, you can have so many apartment buildings and so many single homes and so many duplexes and whatever. Those things all have good economic theory, depending on how it's applied, of course, but there's theory to that. There's some sound theory to rent control, as in you can only raise it so much, and we're going to link that raise to something like standard of living or inflation or whatever metric you want to. That has some sound economic theory to it. A city or a municipality just coming in and saying, no, you can't raise rent for X amount of time because there's a pandemic or there's some kind of a crisis or World War II or whatever that comes out. Okay, temporary, sure. Maybe not the best policy, but you can defend that. If you just come out and say you're only allowed to pay X amount of rent for a building, no matter where it is in the city, regardless of whatever, that starts getting into some really crazy town areas. Walk us through that, because those are all different things, but they all just get slapped as rent control and people just hear, oh, I don't have to pay an exorbitant amount of rent, which is a problem in some places. You don't want people getting gouged, but this is something where the details really, really, really matter.
Yeah, the details do matter. You're right that there are various forms of rent control. In St. Paul, Minnesota, they capped rent increases to a little under 5% a year. Other places have looked at just trying to cap rents, trying to tie it to inflation. Others have tried to tie it to the cost of living in certain areas. And you make a good point that they all are different. But I think that the prescription of any of them is the result of misdiagnosing the cause of the issue. So we can all agree that we would love people to be able to afford housing. I don't think that that's a controversial point. We can also agree that we don't like when the cost of rent is high. We don't like when the cost of housing is high. We don't love when interest rates and mortgages are super expensive. But the problem is we have to understand, why is it the case that they're expensive if we want to prescribe the correct solution? And so a lot of progressive individuals love to look at rent prices as too high and argue that they need to be capped. That's one way to go about it. You do make a good point that there's various rent control formulations that different localities can put together. I believe at the end of the day, they're all poor policy choices, because the reason that housing is ever too expensive in a specific area is because there's not an adequate supply of it for the people who demand it. There is some, I'm being generous here, there is some economic basis for things like zoning laws. I don't think they're very good. I believe that if, as an investor, as a developer, I believe building a high-rise apartment in a specific area is going to be financially profitable for me, I think that that is far more important than individuals wanting to preserve, let's say, the character of their neighborhoods, of the areas they grew up in. I'm not saying those things aren't valuable. I understand the desire to, let's say, have the value of your house increase over time. Well, you're going to want zoning laws because you want to constrict supply. Or maybe you just have an affinity for where you grew up, or you have an affinity for the character of the town that you've lived in your entire life. You don't want to see that change. That those are real human emotions that are important. They need to be taken into account. But I don't think we should sacrifice the affordability of housing and take away, at the end of the day, the freedom of individuals to employ their dollars in the way that they see fit to preserve those things that we have an emotional tie to. Because if we want housing to be affordable, we should not try to cap rents, which would then reduce individuals' incentive to increase the housing supply. If I cap the amount people can make off of creating rental housing, then they're not going to create it. You know, when St. Paul in Minneapolis passed various versions of rent reforms, now Minneapolis never actually went through with implementing any sort of rent control, but St. Paul did. Their city governments, their phones, this was reported in their newspapers, were ringing off the hook with developers putting pauses on plans to create more housing. That's what happens when you implement rent control. And St. Paul didn't put a cap on rents. They put a cap on how much you could increase rents over time. And they were getting calls nonstop about developers pausing their projects. So the issue is that there's not enough housing. It's not that that landlords are greedy and want to squeeze out money from people. Yes, we are profit maximizing individuals when we're working in the economy, but that profit incentive is what creates abundance for consumers. And so we want developers to be able to respond to proper price signals so that they can create more housing when there is a demand for too little of it. When there's a demand for too little housing, prices are going to go up. We want developers to then invest in creating more housing in an attempt to try and capture a piece of those greater potential profits being signaled by prices. I think rent control is really important. I understand the arguments for zoning. I understand the arguments for rent control. But at the end of the day, they misdiagnose the problem and they create unintended consequences that hurt the renters that we're seeking to help.
Benjamin Ianian joining us. Let's talk universal healthcare for a minute. I always preface this argument with two things about myself when I talk to people. I was like, you need to understand two things about me. I've lived in Europe twice. I've been a patient in a German hospital where they have, you know, a form of universal healthcare. I've been a patient in their hospital. I've ridden in their ambulance. They gave me a ketamine shot. If you ever want to know what a ketamine shot's like, that's like in Star Wars where all the starfield just kind of goes left for work. That's what that's like. I've been in Europe. I've lived in Europe. I've seen how they live, how they do healthcare. Excellent healthcare, by the way. German hospitals are fantastic. I'm also a VA patient, Veterans Affairs Hospital patient here, which is the closest thing to universal healthcare we have in America right now, largest hospital system in America. So don't shine me on when you want to talk about universal healthcare. I've seen it good, bad, and indifferent. And there are good parts to it. There are good arguments for it. There's a lot of bad arguments for it. The problem I find is people don't want to take the argument in its totality. They say, well, we should just have universal health care as if that's going to fix all the problems. It doesn't fix all the problems. It creates another set of problems because there's trade-offs and everything. Yes, Europe, places like Germany, they have excellent health care that they don't really have to pay for, except in certain areas. They also pay about 68% taxes on the average family. That's something most Americans are not going to want to do. You have to reorder your society around that kind of healthcare, like Britain's finding out with their national health system right now. It's not enough to just have an NHS. You have to pretty much reorder your entire government spending plan and society around that NHS. There are the trade-offs involved in this. I get a little frustrated with people that just think the buzzword's going to fix. And it's like, no, first of all, in America, you would have to disassemble the employee-driven health insurance program, which is a massive business, multi-billion dollar business, then you would have to restructure the entire price incentives and structures of the hospital system, another multi-billion dollar, one of the largest industries in America, if you actually look at it per money spent and earned. I don't think people understand what they mean when they say it. Yes, universal healthcare has good points. These are extremely, some of the most complex policy things we can discuss, and we've managed to buzzword them into something to just yell at each other on social media about.
Yeah. They get boiled. They get diluted, I should say. The arguments get diluted. They get boiled down to simple buzzwords, like you said. They're very complex issues. Now, all of these policies that we're discussing today, right, I devote an entire chapter in my book to each one of them. So there's no way in this podcast I can go through all of the nitty-gritty details or empirical examples or even the data on all of these different policies. Free healthcare, universal healthcare, this is the longest chapter in the book, and it's for a reason. Like you said, it's a very complicated issue. It was the most complicated one to write. It was the hardest one, I would say, to explain in layman's terms. Now, universal healthcare is, again, a solution to a problem with a misdiagnosed cause, in my opinion. Now, just like rent control, just like minimum wage laws, free healthcare on its surface has a fine logical argument to it, right? You know, healthcare is incredibly expensive. We want people to be able to get treatment for their medical problems. Free healthcare is a solution. If we just follow that line of thought, it's a logical proposal. The issue is, A, if we don't understand why healthcare is expensive in the first place, we're unlikely to propose the right solution. And if we did understand why healthcare was so expensive in the first place, we would be unlikely to propose free healthcare. And if we don't truly understand the possible consequences of free healthcare, and I hate saying free healthcare, actually, it's taxpayer funded. There's nothing that's free that's provided by the government. The government doesn't have its own money. It has our money. And it has debtors' money that they have to pay back at a certain point, or at least keep financing until, you know, hopefully no day of reckoning comes. It will come one day, but they just have to keep financing the debt spending at that point, or, you know, they have to tax us into oblivion in a sense, as you said, you know, very high tax rates, 60, 70% to pay for these sorts of policies. Now, universal healthcare or taxpayer-funded healthcare is a very popular issue on the left, and it's even becoming more popular on the right as time goes on. The issue with that is we don't understand why healthcare is so expensive in the first place. I agree it's a tragedy that potential patients, that everyday consumers are having to forego medical treatment for financial reasons. In 2022, 38% of respondents to a Gallup poll said that they had foregone medical treatment due to financial reasons. That is a tragedy. Now, around those times, we were seeing very high inflation, so people's pocketbooks were squeezed even further, but it's been pretty consistent over the last couple of decades. 25% plus of individuals are foregoing medical treatment. The question is, why is medical care so expensive? And any industry that you see that is wildly expensive, that is supposed to be for everyday consumers, you're going to find out that it's one of the most highly regulated industries in the country. Regulation makes industry more expensive. It increases compliance costs. It increases red tape. You got to hire more people to comply with and do all this paperwork and work with government agencies. So I want to just touch on a few factors for the high price of healthcare these days. The first one, the most important one, is the third-party payer system. A lot of individuals don't understand, why is insurance such a big part of healthcare today? Why is a third party paying for so many of my healthcare costs? Well, back in the 1920s, when healthcare started to improve and become more effective, it also became more expensive at the time, hospitals were seeing that they still didn't have a lot of patients coming in. So Baylor Hospital offered to a group of school teachers that if they paid, a certain amount, a very small amount, to the hospital as in an insurance plan, the hospital would cover their treatments when they came in to get looked at, if they came in for checkups, or if they, needed a wound healed, whatever. That is really where the idea of insurance was born. Now, during World War II, we started to see employer-sponsored health insurance, what we really see today, where your insurer pays a lot of your premiums and then you pay part of them and you get your insurance through your employer. We started seeing that really tick up during World War II, when a lot of men were off at war and they needed to attract workers to come work in their various businesses. They started offering employer-sponsored health insurance at the time. Over the years, various government regulations cemented employer-sponsored health insurance as a non-taxable benefit. So it became wildly popular. Employers could now pay not wages or not salaries that would be taxed for them and their employees. They could now offer non-taxable health insurance. So what we see now is that many Americans get their insurance through their employers. We see over insurance now, right? Because instead, if individuals could receive their compensation in income, they might not choose to insure themselves at the same level. They might not need it. It might not, be worth it for them. For whatever reason, they might choose to spend that money in another way. But instead, we have billions and billions of dollars, $1 trillion flowing in to employer-sponsored health insurance plans. And so now you have an overinsured society, which artificially inflates demand for healthcare, which increases prices, which increases a need for more insurance, which increases insurance, which then increases demand and increases prices, which necessitates the need for more insurance. Again, you have this unending loop of putting upward pressure on healthcare prices where third parties are covering these things. And at the end of the day, if a third party is covering it, if I'm a doctor and a third party is going to pay this fee, I'm going to get paid anyway. I might as well get paid some more. So prices are just have this unrelenting upward pressure on it. And then you have government regulation. I know I've been rambling on for a little bit, so I'll just stick to one regulation that I discuss in the book here. Hopefully you guys will all read the book to read about the others. But certificate of need laws are a great example of the government really restricting the supply of medical treatment. In around 30 states, over 30 states, I believe it's 35 in the District of Columbia, 35 states in the District of Columbia have certificate of need laws. And the way certificate of need laws generally work is that if I want to build a hospital or I want to, let's say, expand certain medical services that I have at my medical institution, I typically have to go to a board to get a certificate of need, which is a license to expand those medical services. Now, to get that certificate of need, I have to do exactly what the regulation sounds like. I have to prove that there is a need for the medical services that I want to create. I can't just invest in it as a entrepreneur. I can't invest in creating more medical care because I think it'll be profitable. I have to prove to this central authority that there is a need for it. Well, who's going to lobby that central authority? It's going to be the current players who don't want more competition and who want to have greater pricing power and higher prices. So a lot of applicants are rejected. And we actually see that in localities that have certificate of need laws, they tend to have far higher prices. It's around 11%, I believe, higher prices than places that do not have certificate of need laws. And so the government, through all kinds of red tape, through certificate of need laws, through Obamacare, which I really get into in the book, creates consolidation within the marketplace, puts all kinds of regulatory costs on medical institutions, and drives the price upward greatly. And so again, what I implore progressives or even centrist conservatives, now I talk to progressives in this book, because free healthcare is generally a progressive policy. Progressives are the ones advocating for it. I implore them to see what's causing these problems. And the problem is that the government is way too involved in healthcare. Instead of having the government take over healthcare, which if you would like me to get into it, Andrew, the reasons that I think that would be a catastrophe in the United States, I implore them to see that the solution to these problems is rolling back the government involvement that caused the problems in the first place.
Yeah, Benjamin Hyane joining us. Let me give an example of this big picture, though, because why economically this is a problem. I'm glad you touched on the CON laws, the certificate of need laws. People talk about free healthcare as this, you know, salve that's going to solve all our problems. And again, it's not free. It's coming from tax dollars, right? I can just point, we have an example before us in the Veterans Affairs Administration. I don't think people understand, because I keep bringing this point up over the years and people still argue with me. I'm like, no, go Google's a thing. You can look this up. The Veterans Affairs is the second largest department of the United States government after the DOD. Third, if you count the Postal Service, but that's its own thing usually. But it's one of the two or three biggest. Okay. It's the largest integrated health system in the country. There's nothing even close to it. Right. And for all that money, 300 some odd billion a year on the federal dole, the largest integrated health system in America, one of the largest departments of our government, bigger than the next two or three combined. That's taking care of 9 million people. We have 300 million people in America. There's 15 million veterans, but only 9 million of them get the health care soon. So if the second biggest department of the government is required to take care of just 9 million people, I can't do that math. You went to college up in Minnesota. Maybe they taught you how to handle a number that big. What kind of percentage growth would that be to scale something like that up to 330 million? It's mind-bogglingly impossible. It would eat a federal government who, by the way, our expenditures on the national debt is now going to be our largest expenditure by a lot. It's something like $890 billion a year. The economics of this isn't matching reality. And I think to kind of cut through this to something that a simpleton like me can understand is having this hybrid system with the third party, with it basically being based on a post-World War II system of benefits over the actual services, like you just walked through with everybody else. It's a benefit that employers wanted to give. That's how we got here. And now we have this massive sector of the economy. There's something like 20 states where the biggest sector of their state's economy is now healthcare services. This is something that we have hybrided it to the point where it is worse for everybody. And by the way, let's keep this in perspective. We still have the best healthcare of anywhere in the world. Don't let somebody fool you. We do. I understand lower tier folks have problems accessing it. That's a separate issue. But yes, we have much better healthcare than most of Europe. We just do. But the way we have hybrided it and it's become a profit-based system for certain people, progressives aren't wrong about the profit-based system part of it being a problem. That is a problem. Where I think we're missing the boat, and some of the populist people on the right are starting to grab onto this, and I think it's wrong too, is we're not understanding why certain people are profiting of it. It's because we have this hybrid monstrosity of a system, but we think that just throwing more money on it, if the VA is that big to take care of 9 million people, there's no way you're going to take care of 330 million and growing amount of people without a complete reordering of American society that isn't going to happen. So where do we start? Because that's a problem so big that I don't think most people can even get their head around it, because I can't, and I try.
Yeah, free healthcare is this huge proposition. The estimates are that a Medicare for all system would cost about $30 trillion over 10, you know, the next 10 years. Could cost up to $40 trillion, depending on the estimates that you look at. So that's at least $3 trillion a year. Just to put that in perspective, in 2022, the federal government expenditures were $6 trillion. So $3 trillion is 50% of that. We'd be adding 50% to expenditures. Now expenditures are just going to keep increasing anyway. If the question is, where do we start on healthcare? Because I don't think that the question is, where do we start on free healthcare? Because free healthcare is a nightmare that is going to, I mean, our country's already bankrupt. I think that's important to point out. I mean, $35 trillion is what we're coming up on in national debt. We're having to finance more and more. As you said, interest payments are becoming the highest cost of the federal budget. Now, we don't have money just to throw around. Like, people think that the national debt is this thing off in the corner that doesn't really matter. It's this mystical idea. It's financed by real money. I mean, it has to be. So there's two ways to finance deficit spending. The Federal Reserve can print new money, so that creates inflation by increasing the supply of dollars, or we can borrow it, right? And then continuously have to try and finance it more and more and more. So the financing, the borrowing, comes from real dollars. It comes from everyday investors who are going to put their money into government bonds instead of investing it into private productive activities, right? That's going to slow rise in living standards. So even if there's no catastrophic event on the horizon as a result of the debt, the financing this debt has real impact on people. It suppresses the rise in standard of living. So if we're talking about free healthcare, it's not plausible from an economic standpoint. But then the question becomes, okay, where do we start in fixing this problem? Well, I would get rid of the tax benefit of the employer sponsored health insurance plans. I don't think it should be a non-taxable good. I don't think it should have special treatment. It's what is fueling this rise in the third party payer system that is putting relentless pressure on healthcare costs.
It's also making a caste system. Not to interrupt you, but the other part of this is, this is an inane argument because everybody, well, we'll do Medicare for all. Well, Medicare is designed for people that aren't employed, either retirees or not working or disabled or whatever. Just by going off that nomenclature, if you have a worker-based system, and then you're going to have something else for everybody else, and now you've already, just by design, built into the system, made this two-tiered system right off the bat before you've done anything else. So I hate to interrupt you, but that's a very important part of this that nobody seems to really address is, no, wait a minute. If you have the employee base and the entire system is based on employee base, then you're going to have government, because that's the only other thing big enough to do it, a government alternative to that. And you've just built this inherent chasm in the system right from the jump.
Yeah, it's a huge two-tiered system as a result of that. You know, if you're not working, then you're stuck in a system that is designed because of government regulations for working individuals, right? The entire system is designed that way. And so now if you're kind of left out of the party, you're going to need these other alternatives. And it's a really important point. Again, I believe that that main problem is created by too much government intervention. Like it's a result of a special tax treatment, right? If there was no special tax treatment on this insurance ecosystem, we would see a lot of individuals take more of their remuneration in the form of income. And then we would not have this employer-sponsored healthcare system that is creating this terrible feedback loop that is just putting relentless upward pressure on the prices of healthcare. And so I don't think it should have special tax treatment. I think that's a major problem. Certificate of need laws have to go. Obamacare was a disaster because the way it incentivizes consolidation. I'm not going to get into the details of that right now because I could go on for that about an hour. I'd recommend, again, people go to the book for the details of that. But Obamacare incentivizes outpatient and doctor-owned practices to merge with large healthcare entities. It incentivizes smaller hospitals to merge with larger ones. And this was actually an explicit goal, which I talk about in the book. It was an explicit goal of the Obamacare authors. They thought consolidation would make things more efficient. It would lower costs. It's had the complete opposite effect. Obamacare was a disaster. Certificate of need laws are a huge problem. And the tax benefit that we have on employer-sponsored healthcare, right? These are, I talk about a couple of other major issues in the book, but these are really core pillars as to what is causing the major healthcare cost increases that we're seeing in this country. And so I think that it's a very fair problem to look at and say something needs to be done. But it's very simplistic to say, well, the government should just fund it. Because as we talked about at the beginning of the discussion on this issue, it's not economically feasible. Right, it's going to cost tons of money that we don't have. We're going to have to jack up taxes. But even if we did that, we still wouldn't be funding it. Right, we have this illusion that taxes are funding the government. They fund some of it, right? The rest of it has to be funded by borrowing. That's why our debt is. I mean, go online and Google the national debt clock and watch it spin out of control. Now, don't look at it for too long, or else you might have anxiety. But it's a real problem, right? Because if we want healthcare to be better, we want it to be more affordable, we should remove government from the equation instead of have it take over everything, which if you look at other countries like the UK, like Canada, they see massive wait times, they see huge increases in taxes. People can't get in to see the specialist that they need to see in a prompt manner because they've created this free system that disincentivizes investment and growth in the system, and also, again, vastly increases demand in a way that's not sustainable. So now you might make a mess of your healthcare system. On top of that, you're gonna have to reorder your entire society. You're gonna have to increase taxes. You're gonna have to borrow more money. Now you're gonna be ripping more and more dollars that would have otherwise gone into investing in growing businesses, in improving technology, in increasing better, more affordable goods and services. Like at the end of the day, the increase in living standards come from innovation. Matt Ridley has this great quote. I hope I don't butcher it, but it's that innovation is the child of freedom and the parent of prosperity. If you take away the dollars that would be invested into innovation, because you're now taxing it so much to pay for this healthcare system, you're not going to see investment in innovation. You're not going to then see prosperity in what we hope to see. All of these problems come down to this idea that we want to see people have better, cheaper goods and services. If we make healthcare free, we're going to make a mess of it. And on top of that, we're going to really hamstring that positive feedback loop of freedom, innovation, and then prosperity, because there's not going to be as many dollars to go towards that process.
Benjamin Ihanian joining us. He's the author of Beyond Intention. Last part of your book, and a good way to kind of wrap this up, because we've been kind of dancing around it a couple times during this discussion, but you talk about the wealth tax. I already brought it up. The servicing of the national debt, it either has or is going to or will surpass the DOD as the biggest expenditure of the federal government. It's estimated to be around $890 billion, give or take, depending on which number you want to use. Some say 840, some say 910. That's still too big, but that's going to be the biggest expenditure. Paying the interest on the debt is the most money the federal government is spending. That is insane. Try doing that in your private life. You will wind up bankrupt or worse. And yet we don't really seem to care very much. The problem with the wealth tax, not that the wealthy shouldn't be paying a disproportionate amount of taxes, because any economic model, of course, the wealthy would pay more taxes. The problem is the way it's set up is only the wealthy can afford to get around paying taxes, and they're going to figure out a way to get away it. This is why, and you cite the examples, we won't get into the details, but most European countries that have tried this, those folks just take their money and pick up and go somewhere else, that sort of thing. It never brings in the money, they say. But the fact of the matter is, with the spending and the debt problems we have, you could confiscate the 1%'s wealth and it still wouldn't be enough to keep up. You just mentioned it. You know, if you want to do universal health care, you're going to multitudes expand the federal government. You just can't get enough money to pay for this. At some point, spending has to be dealt with, and a wealth tax isn't going to put a dent in the actual problem. While it will make people feel good, and yes, I think the rich should be paying a lot more than the working guy at the factory, everybody agrees on that. In practicality, that's not really going to solve the core problem they're thinking it's going to solve.
Yeah, it's going to take in way less money than they always project. Now, there's a twofold problem. You know, one is the wealthy can pay to find various ways, loopholes in the tax code, let's say, to avoid paying the tax. But the bigger issue is what you pointed to, that they pack up their bags and they leave. And I think that that is honestly a fair response when a country is becoming hostile to you solely on the basis of your success. So the top 1% already pays a disproportionate amount of taxes in the country. The top 1% of income earners in 2020, they reported 22% of all adjusted gross income in the United States. They paid 42.3% of federal income taxes. The bottom 50% of earners reported, 10% of all adjusted gross income. They paid 2.3% of all federal income taxes. So we hear all the time that people that the wealthy need to pay their fair share. But for one, there's no definition to that. And two, we have to consider, at what point does what someone else makes belong to you, right? Because, I mean, we need to have that discussion. If people are saying the wealthy need to pay their fair share, when, again, they're paying 42% of federal income taxes when reporting 22% of the income. But they're going to be incentivized to leave our country if we do that. And people might wonder, well, what's the big problem? If they don't want to pay the tax, then fine, they should leave the country. Why would we want the most productive members? I'm not saying they're the best. I'm just saying, like, just from a pure economic standpoint, the most productive members of society, why would we want them to pick up and leave? That would be catastrophic for a multitude of reasons. First off, they're the ones who create the biggest businesses that employ the most jobs, that give us the best goods and services. How do we think the founders of Amazon, how do we think Jeff Bezos, how do we think Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, how do people think these individuals got rich? They got rich because they created businesses that people value and they got compensated accordingly. They did not become rich because they put a gun to your head and forced you to order off of Amazon. I mean, they got rich because you order something from Amazon and 2 hours later, a package is hitting you in the back of the head and it's cheap enough for you to use it, right? So it's important to not demonize people just because they're wealthy. And that's where progressives are going a lot of these days. And then, as you point out, there are a ton of European countries. There's 12 OECD countries who had wealth taxes in the 90s. Only three of them have them today. And in the book, I go through all the different examples of why did these individual countries decide to repeal the wealth taxes. They repealed them mainly because they found that they were unfair towards productive activity, right? They taxed people who were successful, so then they didn't want to invest as much in being successful. They didn't want to create jobs. They didn't want to create better goods and services because, again, that profit incentive is gone. But the biggest issue in most of these countries is that the wealthy fled. They took their wealth, They took their businesses, they took their investment, they took their productive activities to other countries where people benefited, as opposed to the countries that they originally were in. And it is a huge lesson for Americans. Even if you could get the wealthy to pay in the sense that they can't just get around it by some funky tax loophole, they're going to want to leave. And then at what point is the United States going to do? Bar the wealthy from traveling abroad? I mean, are we trying to become the Soviet Union? Because that's the next logical step. If we want to force them to pay it, we're going to have to stop them from leaving. And if you do that, okay, now you're the Soviet Union, which I hope Americans don't want to become. I think it's really important to understand the magnitude and the depth of these policy proposals, because their logical conclusions would have a huge effect on the living standards of Americans. When we say that these are solutions that we want to employ to improve living standards in this country, we have to then understand, well, what are the consequences of these quote unquote solutions? And as I go through each various policy in this book, and there's a couple other that Andrew and I won't touch on today, these policies would end up harming the very people that they're meant to help. I mean, the full title of the book is Beyond Intention: How Progressive Policy Initiatives Would Harm the Most Vulnerable, right? That is the point in this book, is that I'm writing it because I care about the working class. I care about the poor. I care about the sick. I care about workers, renters, entrepreneurs. I care about everybody the same. And I am a libertarian. I'm what you would call a bleeding heart libertarian. I am a libertarian because I believe libertarianism is best and most beneficial for the working class and for the poor. And that's really the crux of the book and all of these policies we're talking, and the wealth tax is a prime example. It's meant to help the poor. I think that progressives have good intentions. We need to go beyond the intentions, because when we do, we understand that things like the wealth tax would have catastrophic consequences for the very people that it's aimed to help.
Yeah, but I've seen libertarians try to have a convention, so it always makes me kind of step back a little bit, to be fair.
I'll put a disclaimer. I'm a small L libertarian.
We're going to beat up on the others. We got to point at our own mess too. Y'all don't seem to be able to do very much. It's inherent to libertarianism. They don't do collective working very well. They don't play well with each other sometimes, but that's just to be fair. Benjamin Nyanian, this is heavy stuff. You got to be able to laugh at it a little bit, but I like what you say. Like, look, yes, there's some evil people. Most people are not evil. They just have their own ideas on how to work. And then we kind of got to get past that a little bit. Like, okay, you have a good intention, I have a good intention, let's see if this is actually going to work or not, and start talking through this. So I appreciate you saying that. We got to laugh about this stuff, man, because look, this is heavy stuff that impacts people, but we also can't take ourselves so seriously, because if you take yourself too seriously, you might miss that one or two points that other side has that you might miss. It probably, if nothing else, might make you at least think about it a little bit more.
Yeah, it's really important to truly meet people where they're at, right? I think that a lot of policy discussions devolve into arguments, into yelling, into accusations against other people's character. I see that on the right. I see that on the left. I see it in the libertarian community. I see it in the classical liberal wing as well of the libertarian community. Like, every faction is trying to make the claim that they're more moral than their interlocutors. And there is a moral component to the reason why we all believe what we believe. Now, the problem is that it's what I think is driving our intentions. And so I think a lot of times we can throw morality out. Now, I think that libertarian principles, just from a principle standpoint, because they respect people's individuality, I could go on for days about why I think that that's the most moral makeup. But I'm not going to sit here and say that progressives or socialists who I'm talking to are necessarily less morally intelligent than a libertarian. I think that that is wrong. I don't think that it's productive. I think that they have very moral ends, and then they have adopted their certain principles and their certain beliefs on how to achieve those ends. So I don't think that it is right for us to devolve into questions of morality whenever we are having these big picture debates. And that the reason that I think we don't reach across the aisle very often is because we are do not want to devolve into these debates about morality, because we don't want our character to be questioned and we don't want to have these very heated and hostile conversations. And that was another huge motivator for me writing this book. So it's the reason why the title isn't progressives are evil, stay away from their policies. It's the reason why the title isn't progressives, you guys need to get smarter. What do you not understand, right? Because there's a couple of reasons. One, the humility is a thing, right? There's always a possibility that I'm not right about things that I'm writing online every day or in this book that I've published. That's very heavily researched. Andrew, you read the book. There's a million bajillion citations. You guys can check whatever I've linked to in the book. But we need to be humble and understand that there might be something that we haven't considered. So we need to meet people where they're at. And more importantly, we need to meet people where they're at if we want to bring them to our side of the policy discussions. So that's why the title is what it is. It's beyond intention. It's, listen, I'm going to not call you immoral. I'm not going to call you an idiot. I'm going to acknowledge you have good intentions. And if we just look at what the problem is, here's my intention, here's your solution. I will admit that on its basis, that what you are saying, let's say as a progressive or even a big government conservative or even a run-of-the-mill Democrat, what you are saying is logical from that point. But my argument in the book is that we need to go beyond all of that. We need to look at the basic economics of these different policies, truly understand how are they going to affect people, truly understand why are the problems that we want to solve existing in the first place. My argument in the book is that if we do that, we start to see better alternative solutions, which I detail in each chapter, but we also see that the problem was often created by too much government intervention. And that the answer is not to have the government take over that area completely, because if they did, it would have all sorts of catastrophic consequences. It would take the consequences we're seeing now from a little bit too much government intervention and blow them up by 100 times if we have the government just take over at all. And so, you know, it's really important to meet people where they're at. We need to understand we all want similar things. We want prosperity. We want health. We want security. We want community. The question is, how do we get there? But if we can start from a point of I'm going to assume you're a good person. I hope you assume I'm a good person. We have similar intentions. If we start from that point, I think we can start to have very fruitful discussions about these different policies.
Benjamin Ayanian, the book's called Beyond Intentions. I have it right here. I have read it. I recommend you read it. We're going to link to it in all the show notes so that y'all can read it. It's heavily cited. It's got all the big words in it, but you can understand it because even I understood it. So you can read it, my friend. Real quick, let folks know where they can not only get the book, where they can keep up with you until we get you back on Herd Tell again. You've been here a couple times. We'll keep having you back as long as you want to keep coming. Let folks know where they can keep up with you until we get you on Herd Tell again, my friend.
Yeah, you guys can find the book that I wrote on Amazon.com. If you just search my name, Beyond Attention, or the full title, it'll pop up. You can find me on Twitter at Benjamin Ayanian and also on Instagram at BIanian13. I hope you guys enjoy the book if you give it a read. Andrew, I look forward to the next time we're discussing together.
Yep, Ayan, because I've had to retrain myself how to do that for promotional purposes for all the times he's been on here for the radio audience that can't see it. Buddy, appreciate your time. We'll have you back soon. Talk soon, my friend.
Thanks.
Yes, sir. All the music on Herd Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job, or your deodorant, or your lunch. or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.